On the 10th of February, 1933, 3 weeks after his appointment to Reichschancellor by the First World War Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, Adolf Hitler strides to the speaker's rostrum of the crowded Berlin Sportpalast. By 1940, Adolf Hitler nearly reached the zenith of his power when German troops occupied France and Belgium, where he had served during World War I.
Noch während der Kämpfe um Dünkirchen begab sich der Führer vom Hauptquartier aus an die Front zu seinen Soldaten. Er besucht die Schlachtfelder, auf denen er selbst im Weltkrieg als Soldat gekämpft hat. Generaloberst von Reichenau meldet dem Führer Einzelheiten des Kampfes, der hier auf dem historischen Boden der Flandernschlacht von 1914 tobte. Auf dem Heldenfriedhof von Langemark. Der Führer grüßt hier die Gräber der Kriegsfreiwilligen von 1914, die mit dem Deutschlandlied auf den Lippen gegen den Feind stürmten und ihr junges Leben für das Vaterland hingaben. Der Soldat von 1940 nahm die Fahne dieser toten Helden, die im November 1918 sank, wieder auf und führt sie endgültig zum Siege.
80 years after the end of World War I, over half a century after Hitler's suicide in Berlin, we will follow the course of his military career during the Great War across Flanders and northern France. The period's profound influence on him and its subsequent impact on European history is still underestimated. Never before has Hitler's development during World War I been fully illuminated. Hitler seems to have experienced 1914-1918 in the terrible normality of the times. Were Adolf Hitler and his views really a product of World War I, forged in a storm of steel in Flanders and nurtured in Versailles? Upon the announcement of the murder of the Austrian heir to the throne, Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, on Sunday the 28th of June 1914 in Sarajevo, the 25-year-old Adolf Hitler sat in his rented room at 34 Schleißheimer Street in Munich. He would later recall the events that followed, together with his impressions at that time.
The time that now followed weighed on men like an oppressive nightmare, sultry as feverish tropical heat, so that constant anxiety over the sense of approaching catastrophe turned at last to longing. Let heaven at last give free rein to the fate which could no longer be avoided. Then the mighty lightning flash struck. The storm was unleashed. And with the thunder of heaven mingled the roar of World War batteries.
In the following weeks, Hitler's premonition became a reality. One mobilization and declaration of war followed the other. In a short time, not only were the majority of European countries at war, but by the end of the conflict in 1918, nearly all of the overseas powers also. The German Kaiser Wilhelm II proclaimed on August the 6th, 1914,
"Um sein oder nicht sein, unseres Reiches handelt es sich, dass unsere Väter sich neu gründeten. Um sein oder nicht sein, deutscher Macht und deutschen Wesen. Wir werden uns wehren bis zum letzten Hauch von Mann und Ross. Und wir werden diesen Kampf bestehen, auch gegen eine Welt von Feinden."
A conflict began that would bring untold destruction, death and suffering to millions of people. The First World War. In late summer 1914, few realized the scope of the approaching catastrophe. Nearly all of Europe was engulfed in the fever of war. Whether in Berlin, London or Paris, everywhere, hundreds of thousands gathered to demonstrate and celebrate. Nationalism and patriotism abounded. The recruiting offices of the armed forces were overrun by volunteers. Typical of the numerous mass meetings held all over Germany and Austria at the time was one gathering in front of the Feldenhalle in Munich on August the 2nd, 1914. An enthusiastic, cap-waving and cheering mass of people came together to express their patriotism and sing songs of the fatherland. In this crowd was Adolf Hitler. Heinrich Hoffmann, owner of a small photo shop at 50 Schellingstrasse, took photos of the gathering, including the unknown Hitler. Years later, Hoffmann, by then court photographer to the NSDAP, sat together with Hitler and viewed the photographs. Hitler was discovered at the meeting at the Odeonsplatz. His landlady at the time, Frau Anna Popp, looked back on this day, years later.
"Und dann kam der August 1914 und der Krieg. Ich sehe heute noch den jungen Hitler vor mir stehen, wie er mir die Karte zeigte, die er von der Kabinettskanzlei bekommen hatte, dass er im deutschen Heer dienen durfte."
Probably on the same day, Hitler volunteered for the Bavarian army, even though he held Austrian nationality. Although Hitler's own explanation of his recruitment into the German army is today a point for dispute, it can be established that on August the 16th, 1914, he was issued a uniform by the 2nd Replacement Battalion of Recruiting Depot 6 of the 2nd Bavarian Infantry Regiment in the Munich Elizabeth School. Hitler himself claimed that he reported on August the 5th, but was initially turned away. On September the 1st, 1914, he was transferred to the newly formed Reserve Infantry Regiment 16. Due to security concerning the formation of the reserve regiments, it later came to be known as Regiment List, after its first commander, Colonel Julius List. In this regiment, Adolf Hitler would not only serve throughout the war, but soon come to see it as his new home. About his feelings at this time, Hitler would write in Mein Kampf,
"To me, those hours seemed like a release from the painful feelings of my youth. I am not ashamed today to say that, overwhelmed by a wave of enthusiasm, I sank down on my knees and thanked heaven from an overflowing heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live at this time. As a boy and young man, I had so often felt the desire to prove at least once by deeds that for me national enthusiasm was no empty whim."
On the other hand, Hitler was obviously only too well aware of the dangers approaching him. Frau Anna Popp remembers the day that he said goodbye to the family.
Er nahm meinen Mann bei der Hand und sagte, wenn ich fallen sollte, würde ich Sie bitten, meiner Schwester zu schreiben. Vielleicht möchte sie meine wenigen Sachen haben. Wenn nicht, können Sie sie behalten. Es tut mir leid, dass ich Ihnen Schwierigkeiten mache. Er schüttelte auch mir die Hand, während ich dastand und weinte. Wir alle hatten ihn so gern. Er umarmte Peppi und Liese, die er immer so mochte, drehte sich um und eilte davon.
After Hitler's transfer to Regiment List, there followed a hard phase of training in Munich that ended on October the 8th, 1914, with a regimental oath and leave-taking ceremony. It was presided over by King Ludwig II on the camp parade ground of the Türkengaserne, formerly the barracks of the Royal Bavarian Infantry Bodyguard Regiment, and almost completely destroyed during World War II. On Saturday, October the 10th, Regiment List left Munich to take part in a 10-day large-scale manoeuvre on the Lechfeld. As Hitler wrote in a letter to Mr. and Mrs. Popp, the first 5 days of this training were the hardest of his life. On October the 21st, Regiment List, a part of the 6th Bavarian Reserve Regiment, was loaded onto 3 transport trains and set off for Flanders. Adolf Hitler went to war. For Hitler, the journey to Flanders was an unforgettable experience. Even in 1944, 1 year before his suicide, his thoughts returned to the day on which he saw the Rhine and the historical Niederwald monument near Rüdesheim for the first time in his life.
The feelings which the sight of this historic river inspired in me remain forever engraved on my heart. The kindness and spontaneity of the Rhinelander also made a profound impression on me. Everywhere they received us and feted us in a most touching manner. The evening we reached Aachen, I remember thinking that I should never forget that day for the rest of my life. And indeed, the memory of it remains today as vivid as ever.
From Aachen, Regiment List continued to Herbestal, where, during the night of the 22nd of October, they reached the Belgian border. Afterwards, the journey continued over Lüttich and Brussels to Lille, where Hitler arrived the following day. During the next day, all units of the 6th Bavarian Reserve Regiment were deployed. For the following 72 hours, they remained in reserve for Duke Albrecht von Württemberg's 4th Army. After 3 days' rest, on the 26th of October, the 6th Division received marching orders to the front, south of Werwick-Kommin, which for Hitler and his comrades entailed a series of long foot marches. Around 6 o'clock on the morning of October the 29th, they reached the main Menin-Ypres road near Kolberg. At 6:45 hours, Hitler's battalion deployed to the right of the Ypres road for a frontal attack on Gehluwelt, defended by troops of the 1st British Corps under General Haig. There, in a larch wood near the road to Beccalaire, Hitler received his baptism of fire. Nobody today could imagine the amount of blood spilt over this peaceful-looking countryside.
And then came a damp, cold night in Flanders, through which we marched in silence. When the day emerged from the mists, suddenly, an iron greeting came whizzing at us over our heads, and with a sharp report, sent tiny fragments flying among our ranks, ploughing up the wet ground. But even before the little cloud had passed, from 200 throats, the first hurrah rose to meet the first messenger of death. Then a crackling and a roaring, a singing and a howling began, and with feverish eyes, each of us was drawn forward faster and faster, until suddenly, past turnip fields and hedges, the fight began, the fight of man against man.
Following his baptism of fire, Hitler and his comrades experienced one costly attack after another, as he later graphically described in a letter to his friend, Ernst Hepp.
4 times we advanced and must again retreat. Out of my entire group, there is only one person left apart from me. Finally, he also falls. A shot rips the whole right sleeve of my uniform jacket off, but by some miracle I remain healthy and uninjured. At last, around 0200 hours, we go forward for a fifth time, and this time take the woods and farm buildings. In the evening, around 0500, we gather and dig in some 100 meters from the road.
In the attack on the British trenches in and around the park of Geluweld Manor, casualties among Hitler's battalion included Commander Graf von Zech auf Neuhofen. On the 30th and 31st of October, the attack on Geluweld resumed. Only a third of Hitler's battalion remained. The new commander, Captain Franz Rubenbauer, reported, "We in the centre have no battalion any more, hardly a full company. The men stand over 48 hours in battle and have not rested for 3 nights. The troops are exhausted." After heavy fighting and further losses, including the regimental commander, Colonel Julius List, who was torn to pieces by shrapnel, Hitler and his comrades managed to take the town. Their highly respected commander was buried near the pond in the park of Geluweld Manor. He was ultimately reinterred in a mass grave at the military cemetery Langemark with over 24,000 other German soldiers. On Sunday, the evening of November the 1st, the Reserve Regiment 16 was taken out of the line. Its battle strength stood at 750 NCOs and men, and 8 officers, 4 of whom were medical personnel. From the initial 3,000 soldiers of the regiment, 70% were killed, wounded, or missing. For Hitler, his baptism of fire was a shocking but stimulating experience, the effect of which he graphically described.
4 days later, we came back. Even our step had changed. 17-year-old boys now looked like men. The volunteers of the List regiment may not have learned to fight properly, but they knew how to die like old soldiers. This was the beginning.
Also revealing is the nickname the ordinary German soldier gave the continuing battle, the Child Murder of Ypres. Adolf Hitler's first clash with British soldiers in Flanders shaped his impression of the British military adversary. His sympathy and great respect for Great Britain in later years was founded on his personal experience during World War I. The renowned British historian and author, Professor Ian Kershaw.
He was struck by the valour and tenacity with which the British fought. He respected the enemy that he was combating in the First World War. And that didn't leave him afterwards, but more than that, he respected the British for building up a world empire. It was, I think, this is the key to his admiration for the British, the fact that they, this small island, small set of islands, had built up this immense world empire with huge power dominating the globe. And later on in the 1940s, he said on numerous occasions that Russia is for us what India was to the British. That was his admiration, how this small population could basically rule the world and could dominate, a small number of British could dominate the teeming millions of India as he saw it. So I think it was partly the valour that he experienced in the First World War, but it was above all the way in which the British had been able to build up and exploit this enormous imperial dominance that impressed him greatly.
Hitler reflects his esteem for the British during the former British Prime Minister David Lloyd George's visit to Obersalzburg in 1936. On November the 3rd, 1914, in Wervik, Hitler was promoted to corporal. It was his first and last promotion. He wrote to Joseph Popp, "I am corporal and remain in miraculously good health." After heavy losses on both sides during the Battle of Ypres, the fighting shifted to a static war of attrition. From the Channel to the Swiss border, millions of soldiers dug in and constructed hundreds of miles of defence lines. Men lived like moles to survive. Adolf Hitler who from November the 9th, 1915 until the end of the war, served as a dispatch runner at the headquarters of Regiment List, provided a sober description of the situation in his sector at the end of 1914.
The surroundings are generally flat, with some gentle slopes and with lines of trees. Due to the never-ending rain, we have no winter. The proximity of the sea and the low lay of the land, meadows and fields are bottomless morasses, while the roads are covered with foot-deep mud. Through this swamp wind the trenches with firing points, communication trenches, barbed wire entanglements, spiked pits and mines.
Even after nearly a century, the scars of the war are not healed everywhere in the soil of Flanders. At some locations, time seems to stand still. As a dispatch runner with the regimental staff, Hitler enjoyed a more pleasant life than his comrades in the front line. But this changed when the fighting started. The life expectancy of a dispatch runner was far shorter than that of a normal soldier. When, as was often the case, field telephone lines connecting the battalion command post to company commanders were cut by artillery fire, or radio contact was otherwise not functioning, the orders were carried by dispatch runners. Even under fire, runners had to leave their bunkers for the front line. The losses were correspondingly high. Max Vint, the son of Hitler's regimental comrade and fellow runner Hans Vint, who served with Hitler at regimental headquarters, recalls,
"Mein Vater hat also immer gesagt, wenn es schwere Meldegänge ging, also über ein Gelände, das zum Beispiel vom Feind eingesehen war oder von der feindlichen Artillerie stark beschossen wurde und eben alle Meldegänger an dem Tag schon ihr körperliches Pensum geschafft hatten und es wurde wieder einer gesucht, dann hat er sich in der Regel immer freiwillig gemeldet."
But death came not only beyond the false security of the regimental command post. Even without direct fighting, one lived in constant danger, as a direct hit by French artillery on the regimental command post List on November the 17th, 1914, demonstrated. But Hitler, who during a meeting of company commanders temporarily left the command post, had a lucky escape. As he later described, he was hardly outside for 5 minutes when a shell struck the tent and killed or wounded nearly all the staff. Among the seriously wounded was the new regimental commander, Lieutenant Colonel Philipp Engelhardt, who only 5 days earlier had taken command. Hitler described the scene as the most awful sight of my life. In the 1930s, some of his former comrades published their recollections. The most impressive account of Hitler's life as a dispatch runner is in the book of Balthasar Brandmeier. Brandmeier, who before the war was a bricklayer from Bad Aibling, met Hitler for the first time on May the 30th, 1915, in a dugout in Fornes. During the following time, until Brandmeier was wounded in May 1918, a close friendship developed. Taking into account Hitler's inclination to remain a loner, this was certainly a rarity. Brandmeier, who called Hitler my inseparable comrade, was one of the few allowed to address Hitler as du, the personal form of you. Even in later years, Hitler would not forget his friend. After World War II, Brandmeier returned to his old profession of bricklayer and died on January the 23rd, 1960, at the age of 68, in Putzbrunn, near Munich. Another important witness to Hitler's life as a soldier is Max Amann, who, as a sergeant on the regimental staff, was until the end of the war his superior. Amann, who during the Third Reich, among other things, was manager of the NSDAP, president of the Reich Press Office, and director of Ahr Publishing, recalled during questioning at Nuremberg in 1947 his personal opinion of Hitler. "He was always ready for action. We were always 3 days in the command post and 3 days at rest. And when we were in the command post, the tactical orders had to be carried. And when I, even at 3 o'clock during the night, came in, there were always a couple of runners there. When I called Ordnance, nobody moved, only Hitler jumped up. And when I said, "Always you," he said, "Let the others sleep, it doesn't bother me." He always had his trenching tool strapped on, though we'd thrown ours away long ago. Max Amann died in 1957 and is buried today along with his brother-in-law, Josef Wurm, yet another wartime comrade of Hitler, at the East Cemetery in Munich. Why Hitler did not mention his service as a dispatch runner in Mein Kampf remains unclear. It's possible, as he sometimes hinted, that he was afraid that it may be believed that duty as a dispatch runner was not as risky as that of a normal soldier. However, until his death in 1945, even official publications, such as a training manual for the Hitler Youth, reported on his life as a dispatch runner.
It was a dangerous job. The death rate amongst dispatch runners was high, and they had a risky job to do in carrying messages along the front and so on. But I think probably the answer is simple enough. It is that a dispatch runner doesn't sound as closely involved, unless you know what precisely what a dispatch runner does. It doesn't sound as closely involved in the fighting as if you just say, "I was at the front in the trenches." And the impression that you were a front fighter in the trenches is a more powerful image to convey than saying, "I was a dispatch runner, sometimes actually 3 miles behind the front line and then carrying messages backwards and forwards." And I think that was simply the message that Hitler was wanting to convey, was that he was at one with the people in the trenches because he was one of these people in the trenches. And to say that he'd been a dispatch runner would have created a little bit of a distance from it and suggested that maybe he wasn't quite the brave front fighter that he was alleging he had been.
With few exceptions, Adolf Hitler has been described by his superiors and comrades as a conscientious, though somewhat reserved, soldier. However, such a positive reaction should not be seen solely as a product of propaganda during the Third Reich. An assessment by a former superior is the 1918 opinion of Hitler's deputy regimental commander, Freiherr von Godin. Hitler served in the regiment since it marched out and participated, and distinguished himself in every battle. As a dispatch runner during the war of movement and in the trenches, he showed exemplary cold-bloodedness and zest, and was always ready to volunteer to deliver dispatches under the most difficult conditions and at great peril to his life. Friedrich Wiedemann, who for some time served as adjutant in Regiment List, went so far as to describe Hitler in his 1964 book, The Man Who Wanted to Be a Commander, as the model of the unknown soldier who quietly and calmly did his duty. From the years between the wars, further testimonials exist that describe Hitler's conduct as a soldier. In 1922, the later Major General and former commander of the 16th Regiment, Friedrich Petz, said that Hitler was an extremely diligent, willing, conscientious and dutiful soldier, also reliable and loyal to his superiors. He appeared mentally alert and with physical vitality, capable and persevering. In particular, his personal zeal and unreserved courage, which he displayed in dangerous situations and in battle, should be mentioned. Never did his iron constitution or cold-bloodedness fail him. When the situation was most dangerous, he volunteered to take dispatches to the forward positions and carried out such duties with the best results. Here, a former superior of Hitler once again points to his cold-bloodedness, a characteristic that in the so-called time of struggle of the NSDAP, as well as his time in power in World War II, he displayed on a daily basis.
Hitler and also millions like him who experienced this brutality in the First World War did see life then as, in a different way, life as raw, life as cheap, and life as expendable. And Hitler, in his very, with this absolutely cold, ruthless personality that he had, was certainly more inclined than most to see it in that way. So he said at an early stage in the war, I think in beginning of 1915 or thereabouts, that after his early euphoria had worn off, he now saw that life was one continual struggle and that death was around the corner. And I think that he carried that mentality with him into the Second World War, and he had no compunction about dispatching nameless and faceless thousands or millions to their deaths. And this was a mentality which was bred in him and in, as I said, in countless others by the experience of the First World War. I think without the First World War, the genocidal capacity and the destructiveness that we understand in the Second World War would have been really unimaginable.
Considering all such positive judgments, the question remains, why did Hitler never rise above the rank of corporal during the whole war? Although Wiedemann praised Hitler as a brave and reliable soldier in an almost extravagant manner, he also held the view that he did not possess the necessary qualities for promotion.
The man who later on became an adjutant of Hitler, Fritz Wiedemann, was at this time a regimental adjutant. And he said after the war, after the Second World War, that Hitler had been refused promotion by his superior officers because they reckoned that he lacked leadership qualities, something that I think brought the house down when this was mentioned at Nuremberg in 1946 or something, 48 or something. There seems to be some suggestion that Hitler himself didn't want to be promoted, that promotion might well have meant that he would have being moved away from the group of comrades with whom he was serving, and that from his point of view, he preferred to be in this position. Later on, he also wanted to have the same people around him all the time, and very conservative in that sense. And it may well be that from that point of view, that he was unwilling to be considered for promotion because it would have changed the circumstances with which he was very familiar. I think that's more plausible, but he was a sort of oddity and a bit eccentric, a bit unusual, a bit of somebody who was on the outside. And you could take the view that it's not so much leadership qualities obviously not in a political sense leadership qualities, but rather that he wasn't the sort of person that you would immediately think of running a small group of soldiers. And to this extent, I mean, there may be something in Wiedemann's point that the officers around looked at Hitler and looked a little bit askance at him as officer material and decided that he wasn't really up to it.
During the first month of the war, Hitler maintained contact with several acquaintances at home, and apart from letters, also received parcels of tobacco and food. During 1915, however, he broke all these contacts. Even towards the end of 1916, when Frau Popp tried to please Hitler by sending a Christmas parcel, he was annoyed and wrote curtly that he had enough to eat. Why Hitler himself decided to break contact with his few acquaintances in Munich is not fully understood. Whether, as Ignaz Westenkirchner and Ernst Schmidt claimed, Hitler thought the Austrian police were searching for him as a deserter because without their knowledge he was serving in a German regiment, or that he had done something wrong there, as Schmidt said, remains unclear. Here, Professor Kershaw.
Hitler breaking off contact with his few friends at home back in Munich refers really to the couple of letters which we know survived back from Hitler back to acquaintances that he had in Munich. Some of them were people in whose house he lived while he'd been in Munich in 1913 and 1914. I don't think these were friends in a true sense of the word. And it's quite natural, I think, when someone goes away, that they write back in the early stages back and say, oh, I'll keep in touch, and they write back and send a letter or two, and then the contacts just die away. Hitler wasn't someone who could forge deep friendships. That's the case really right through his life. And I think it would be wrong to see this as a deep friendship which was broken off then, and there's some real significance to that. It seems to me that when he went there, he wrote back in the first stages about what he was experiencing at the front, and then other friends and comrades came on the scene. He was sucked into the war itself, and increasingly, I think he said at one stage that after the first months he realized what a bitter struggle life was and so on. So the early notion that this would be a joyride was rapidly dissipated. And I think from that time on, his regiment, as he said himself, became his home. What was happening in Munich or anywhere else was of lesser concern to him, and life had moved on, and these people had moved really out of his life at that time.
That Hitler was reluctant to accept the Habsburg state of Austria as his homeland is confirmed by Max Wint.
Mein Vater hat ja immer klar und betont zum Ausdruck gebracht, dass Adolf Hitler eben dadurch, dass er keine Angehörigen hatte, wirklich dieses militärische Umfeld, also sprich sein Regiment, als seine Heimat angesehen hat. Der Soldat fühlt sich seiner Einheit zugehörig, sonst könnte er ja gar nicht existieren. Also das klang immer durch, dass sein Regiment seine Heimat ist.
According to Hitler's world ideology, Austria belonged to Germany anyway. Nobody could foresee that on March the 15th, 1938, Adolf Hitler would proclaim before hundreds of thousands of cheering people from the balcony of the Hofburg in Vienna the realization of his dream.
Als Führer und Kanzler der deutschen Nation und des Reichs melde ich vor der deutschen Geschichte nunmehr den Eintritt meiner Heimat in das Deutsche Reich.
Apart from a few comrades close to Hitler, such as Brandmeier and Schmidt, there was one creature he was more attached to than most humans, his dog, Foxel, an English terrier that remained with him for nearly 3 years at the front. Foxel had run away from his slain master in a captured enemy trench. After initial difficulties, Foxel became devoted to Hitler, and apart from when he was in combat, his constant companion.
With exemplary patience, he didn't understand a word of German, I gradually got him used to me. At first I gave him only biscuits and chocolate. The English were better fed than we were. Then I began to train him. He never left my side. The others did not want him. For me, he was also a study in intelligence. I finally taught him everything, jumping over a rope, climbing up and down a ladder. It's essential that a dog should always sleep beside his master.
The same sort of training Hitler would later demonstrate for the camera at the Führer headquarters during World War II with his Alsatian Blondie. During the autumn of 1917, when Foxel was stolen, probably by a railway worker, Hitler's sorrow and anger knew no limit. It seems apparent that the loss of his dog affected him more than the loss of many a comrade. Hitler's relationship with Foxel was the first among many with dogs that would continue throughout the Führer's life. Shortly before his suicide on April the 30th, 1945, Hitler tested a cyanide capsule given to him by his personal physician, Dr. Morell, on his dog, Blondie. She, too, joined him in death. Before Hitler went to war, he earned a modest living through painting and sketching pictures and postcards. Although self-taught, following an unsuccessful attempt to enter the Academy of Art in Vienna, Hitler possessed natural talent. Recalling his unsuccessful entrance exam in Vienna, where the standards of the academy were so high that only 28 out of 128 applicants were accepted, Hitler stated,
"It's all wrong that one's later life should depend on a diploma that one, let's say, at the age of 17 receives. I was a victim of that system myself. I wanted to go to the Academy of Arts and presented my work. The professor asked me which school of building I had attended. Why, I have not attended any. But you must have attended a school of building. You have a clear talent for architecture. On the one hand, that was terrible, because I wanted to attend the painter's class. On the other hand, I realized that he was right. In the Reich, it would have been possible for me to transfer to construction on a Bauakademie. But in Austria, I required the school of building of the technical high school, and the requirements for that were higher qualifications. So the decision was made for me to remain self-taught.
Arriving at the front in 1914, Hitler no longer painted to satisfy the wishes and tastes of his many customers, but followed natural motifs, thus allowing him to complete several spontaneous paintings. Many other soldiers, even in Regiment List, occupied themselves with art. One of the best frontline artists was Otto Engelhard Kufhäuser, who, among other works, painted in the 30s the well-known likeness of Hitler, the Unknown Soldier. Hitler would first become publicly known as a World War I artist, following publication of a collector's folder by the Reich photographer of the NSDAP, Heinrich Hoffmann, in 1935. Whether or not the seven works of Hitler contained in the folder, six watercolors and one sketch, as suggested by Anton Joachim Staller in his painstakingly researched biography covering Hitler's early years, were, prior to their publication, professionally retouched, we will probably never know. One reason for such an assumption could be that Hitler often painted or sketched the same motif several times, and even today this causes much confusion. Another problem for experts and collectors of Hitler's works of art is the uncertainty caused by the so-called Stern-Hitler diary affair and the related forgery by the deceased Konrad Kujau. It's certain, however, that the works of art shown here originate from the hand of Adolf Hitler. The watercolor, Holweg by Wieschater, was probably painted by Hitler shortly after the fighting there on the 15th and 16th of November 1914, just after his baptism of fire in Flanders. It shows the defile near which sappers had built the command post of Regiment List. In the regimental history of the Bavarian Reserve Regiment 16, published after the war, former adjutant Lieutenant George Eichelsdorf recalled an incident in which the regimental commander, Philipp Engelhardt, used the defile to reach the edge of the wood. There, he wished to get a personal look at the fighting, but was spotted and came under fire. He nearly paid for his daring action with his life. The two accompanying regimental runners, Hitler and Buckmann, sprang forward and personally shielded him, warning him that he should protect the regiment from losing a second commander in such a short time. They shoved him into a trench. Without a word, he thanked them with a handshake. Although generally unknown, careful study of battle sketches and questioning of locals leaves no doubt that even though the artillery bombardment left nothing of the wood, the Wieschater defile can be seen today. In the two-day Battle of Wieschater, the regiment List lost 408 dead and wounded. Altogether, the losses suffered by Hitler's unit during the first months were devastating, and in turn, a great burden on the families of the regiment. On November the 17th, 1914, Engelhardt was seriously wounded from a direct hit by French artillery fire on the regimental command post. Shortly before, he had placed Adolf Hitler on the nomination list to be awarded the Iron Cross, second class. Hitler spent Christmas 1914 with the regimental staff in Messines. He was quartered in the nearby farmhouse Bethlehem. According to Hitler's handwritten note, the watercolour shown here was painted in December 1914. In Frommel, where Hitler spent nearly half of his frontline service during World War I, the dressing station of his regiment was located in a partly destroyed building complex, which he painted in 1916. After heavy fighting during the second British major offensive near Fromelles in the summer of 1916, Regiment List was taken out of the line on June the 27th, embarked at the nearby Arbordin station and transferred to the Somme front. The partial view of Arbordin in the Hoffmann folder, mistakenly dated the 15th of June 1916, was actually painted by Hitler on May the 15th of the same year, as can be read when carefully inspecting the painting. In June 1917, Hitler again found himself in Flanders, in the Geluweld sector, where 2.5 years before he received his baptism of fire. In the ensuing Battle of Flanders, the German positions were not only battered by artillery, but also by a 10-day gas attack. Afterwards, on June the 31st, the British offensive began on a 15-mile-long front. During this attack, the wonder weapon tanks, first used 1 year earlier, were again deployed. 2 weeks before, on June the 27th, 1917, Hitler exploited the quiet before the great storm to paint this peaceful scene of the Church of Ardoy and to sketch other pencil motifs.
An artist's profession is one of tragic greatness. Artists must suffer hunger for their great calling. They must really hunger. If they break during this process, then perhaps they were called but not chosen. However, if they emerge victorious in this tragic battle of giants, they can claim the crown of eternal life. There's no other way. It simply cannot be otherwise.
When Adolf Hitler began his political career in 1920, it did not take long before his opponents began to spread misleading stories about his past. It therefore came as no surprise when negative rumors of his time as a soldier during World War I appeared. Due to the mood among the population after all the suffering experienced during the war, the worst that could happen to a politician was to be accused of cowardice in battle or shirking. Hitler had to defend himself time and time again against such claims, practically up until his appointment to Reich Chancellor in 1933, even though he could disprove such accusations. A significant setback was suffered by Hitler's opponents in 1932, shortly before the takeover of power by the National Socialists, when he won a sensational case against the Hamburger magazine Echo of the Week. Another defeat for Hitler's political opponents was when the chief witness for the prosecution, the Social Democrat and war veteran Michael Schlenhuber, completely and surprisingly confirmed Hitler's stainless military conduct. I had known Hitler since we marched out with the Bavarian Reserve Infantry Regiment 16. I experienced Hitler as a good soldier and irreproachable comrade. I never observed that Hitler in any way shirked duty or danger. I was with the division until its return home and never heard anything detrimental about Hitler. I was amazed to read later in the newspaper unfavorable comments about Hitler's performance as a soldier. I stand politically fully opposed to Hitler and only give this verdict because I highly respect Hitler as a war comrade. Even when several former wartime comrades of Hitler tried to defame him, as did the teacher Corbinian Rutz, later sentenced to 3 months in Dachau concentration camp, all attempts to describe Hitler as a coward failed. It must also be said that even Rutz, who due to his claims was persecuted during the Third Reich, admitted after World War II to have lied. A more lurid claim concerning Hitler's life during World War I was made by historian Professor Werner Maser. he claimed that in 1917, in Le Cateau, Hitler conceived a son with the French woman Charlotte Lobjoie. He is said to have met her when quartered in the butcher's shop in the Rue Feidherber in Fromelles. Most well-known historians, such as Anton Joachimsthaler and Professor Ian Kershaw, refute this thesis.
Werner Maser, who's a well-known German authority on Hitler, claimed in the, I think it was the late 60s, early 70s, that that Hitler had fathered a son, Jean Loiret, whilst he was serving in France during the First World War. And for a time, this was a sensation in Germany. It was over the Spiegel and other major German publications then. First of all, you could say that one would be inherently sceptical about this. Hitler was, all those around him in the war, his comrades in the war who later on wrote memoirs, were struck by his absolute, not just his ardent, fervent, fanatical nationalism, but also the fact that he was, one of them described him as a type of monk-like figure who constantly refused to go to brothels and was antagonistic towards the idea of any type of frivolity in the war. And so just from Hitler's personality and his psychology, it is, I think, inherently unlikely. Also in that story, when Loiret wrote his own book on this, claiming that Hitler was his father, there was an impression that you got from this of someone, and it ran through the entire sort of momentary sensation, I think, of a bit of gold digging, that here was somebody who was after a sensation, after trying to get something out of it for himself, some financial advantage. And the third thing, and perhaps most conclusive, is that, if I remember rightly now, the sister of the woman with whom Hitler was reputed to have this short-lived affair producing the son, the sister of the woman denied it herself and said that her sister had had an affair with a German, I think it was an Unterleutnant, a sort of lieutenant, but that this was certainly not Hitler and had no resemblance to Hitler. So the person who was closest in a way to the woman herself denied it. So I think that there was no substance to the story from the beginning. Inherently unlikely, implausible on the evidence of the sister of the woman involved, reputedly involved, doubts about the veracity of the claims put forward by the son, and in any case, you'd have to say that even if it were true, which it is almost certainly not, how significant would it be? Even Maser didn't see it as significant.
Much has been said and written alleging Hitler's ability to sense danger. In fact, when one looks at all the extremely dangerous situations that Hitler survived during the years 1914 to 1945, it's not surprising that many Germans were convinced that the Führer was protected by some mysterious power. This is confirmed by Herbert Döring, one of the last eyewitnesses close to Hitler, who from 1935 to 1943 served as housekeeper at Hitler's mountain retreat near Berchtesgaden.
Du kannst das jeder auslegen, wie er will. Aberglaube, Tatsache. Aber ich habe noch andere Sachen auch und immer wieder ganz extreme Sachen bei Hitler erlebt, weil meine Frau immer sagte, der Hitler wird von einer unsichtbaren, komischen Gewalt geführt. Du kannst sich jeder auslegen, wie er will, ob das Humbug ist oder Tatsache oder beeinflusst irgendwie. Ich habe dann noch andere Sachen im Laufe der Jahre erlebt, das werde ich später nochmal
The zenith of this belief, of nearly religious dimensions, was the assassination attempt on the 20th of July 1944, when Hitler, with almost unbelievable luck, survived the assassination attempt by Count von Stauffenberg. Shortly after this attempt at the Wolf's Lair, Hitler was visited by his three secretaries, among them Traudl Junger. He said, "Now, my ladies, once again, everything has turned out well for me. Further proof that Providence chose me for this calling. Otherwise, then, I would no longer be alive. To Eva Braun, the woman he married a few hours before their suicide, he wrote, I have sent you the uniform from the day of sorrow. It is proof that Providence protects me and that we no longer need fear our enemies. Even during World War I, Hitler, from his baptism of fire to the last time he was wounded in October 1918, appeared to many comrades to be under the protection of a higher power. He was, over and over again, able to show a sixth sense that saved both his and other lives. As an example of numerous experiences also witnessed by his comrades, Hitler recalled years later such a situation to the English journalist Ward Price.
I was eating at midday with several comrades in our trench. Suddenly a voice inside me said, Now get up and get out of here. I believe to have heard that so clearly and emphatically that I mechanically obeyed, as if it was a military order. I stood up and went to a trench some 20 meters away. I took my midday meal and mess tins with me. I then sat down and relaxed. I had hardly started to eat again when from the part of the trench that I had left, an ear-shattering detonation was heard. A stray shell landed exactly where I had been eating with my comrades. They were all dead.
A few weeks later, Adolf Hitler is said to have told several comrades, You will hear a lot from me. Just wait until my time comes. Although when Hitler went to war, his world ideology was certainly influenced by anti-Semitism. There is no doubt that by the end of the war, this had become very radical. After 1918, he would let no opportunity pass to express his peculiar hatred of Jews.
Wenn ich mich recht erinnere, waren in den Anfangszeiten der Bekanntschaft Adolf Hitlers mit meinem Vater Themen wie Antisemitismus nachrangig. Sein Interesse war immer der Bestand des Deutschen Reiches und seiner österreichischen Heimat, die er immer als eine Einheit betrachtet hat. Für ihn war ja Österreich immer ein Teil Deutschlands. Und das ging ja auch aus der Vorgeschichte zum Ersten Weltkrieg eindeutig so hervor. Seine Abneigung galt damals, ich glaube speziell aus seiner Wiener Zeit, den kapitalistischen Bestrebungen. Er hat erkannt, dass nur Kapital, also finanzielle Macht, das Sagen hat. Und da war es natürlich nicht zu vermeiden, dass bei dem Wort Kapital auch das Wort Antisemitismus zur Sprache kam.
Former wartime comrades do not recall a noticeable antipathy of Hitler against Jews. The Hitler biographer and Pulitzer Prize winner John Toland said, He appeared no more anti-Semitic than they themselves were. For Hitler, however, those mainly responsible for World War I and Germany's defeat were Jewry and the Marxists. For the 25-year-old Hitler, they represented an evil alliance. In Mein Kampf, written in Landsberg prison after the failed putsch of November the 9th, 1923, he would describe the situation at the beginning of the war in 1914 in an explicit way.
But now the time had come to take steps against the whole treacherous brotherhood of these Jewish poisoners of the people. Now was the time to deal with them summarily, without the slightest consideration for any screams or complaints that might arise. It should have been the duty of a serious government, now that the German worker had found his way back to his nation, to exterminate mercilessly the agitators who were misleading the nation.
Nobody could imagine the results that Hitler's belief would ultimately have during the Third Reich. But at the beginning of the 20th century and throughout Europe, anti-Semitism was often socially acceptable, even in well-educated circles.
The First World War, I think, was fundamental to shaping Hitler's ideas on the Jews. I think these ideas were formulated in his own mind in the Vienna period before he went to Munich and long before the First War between 1907 and 1913 in Vienna. That was the first period where his anti-Semitism started to form. But the First World War, I think, especially the last couple of years of the First World War, were a very formative period for him in developing his anti-Semitism. And I think it was when, in the autumn of 1916, he was wounded and sent to hospitalization, first near Berlin, and then from there on he went to Munich, that he experienced a very transformed home front to what it had been in 1914, when he left in this wave of euphoria. And when he went back there in 1916, to Berlin and especially to Munich, he was really struck by the difference between the fighting front and the sagging morale on the home front. And in Munich in particular, popular anti-Semitism had started to gain real ground in 1916 and was to develop still further in 1917 and 1918. And in that, when he went back to Munich, according to his later account in Mein Kampf, although in this particular case I don't think we have any particular reason to doubt it, he said that everywhere he went there were Jews who were shirking duties at the front, and they were clerks in offices and so on. Every clerk was a Jew and every Jew was a clerk, was how he put it in Mein Kampf. And the Jews were scapegoated, and Hitler certainly sucked this in. So it really helped to shape up his anti-Semitism, and that was the foundation then of the, of the real vitriolic anti-Semitism that comes out in Hitler for the first time immediately after the First World War.
During the Battle of the Somme, probably on October the 5th, 1916, Hitler was wounded for the first time in his left thigh by shrapnel. After first aid at the front, he was sent to the Red Cross Prussian Military Hospital in Beilitz near Berlin.
2 years had now passed since I had seen the homeland under such conditions a near eternity. I could scarcely imagine how Germans looked not in uniform. As I lay in the field hospital at Hermes, I almost collapsed from fright when suddenly the voice of a German woman serving as a nurse addressed a man lying beside me. For the first time in 2 years to hear such a sound.
But for Hitler, the long-awaited reunion with the homeland became a nightmare. When he could walk again and received permission to travel to Berlin, he was confronted with the harsh reality of the suffering and poverty in the city of millions. After 7 weeks in hospital, he traveled to Munich and saw the conditions there. But he could hardly believe his eyes.
The offices were filled with Jews. Nearly every clerk was a Jew, and nearly every Jew was a clerk. I was amazed at this plethora of warriors of the chosen people and could not help but compare them with their rare representatives at the front. As regards economic life, things were even worse. Here, the Jewish people had become really indispensable. The spider was slowly beginning to suck the blood from the people's pores. Thus, in the year 1916 to 17, nearly the whole of production was under the control of Jewish finance.
When at the beginning of March 1917, Hitler was finally able to return to his regiment, which occupied new positions near La Basse, not far from the Vimy Ridge, he no longer wanted to hear anything about what he had left behind. But of one thing, Corporal Hitler was sure. Someday, the Jews, who he felt were responsible for the present misery, must pay the price. A time bomb that would shake the world had started to tick. The fact that during World War I, from a total of 100,000 Jews serving in the army, over 12,000 gave their lives for Germany, was irrelevant for Hitler. 22 years later, on January the 30th, 1939, Corporal Adolf Hitler, now Reich Chancellor, climbed to the speaker's rostrum in the German Reichstag and proclaimed,
Ich will heute wieder ein Prophet sein. Wenn es dem internationalen Finanzjudentum in und außerhalb Europas gelingen sollte, die Völker noch einmal in einen Weltkrieg zu stürzen, dann wird das Ergebnis nicht die Bolschewisierung der Erde und damit der Sieg des Judentums sein, sondern die Vernichtung der jüdischen Rasse in Europa.
With that, the seed sown on the blood-drenched battlefields of World War I took root. When, on January the 28th, 1918, workers throughout Germany went on strike to protest the famine and the war, end martial law, and demand the election of a democratic government, it seemed only a matter of time before, as in Russia, a revolution would break out. To the high command of the German army, the entry into the war of the USA, with its vast human and material resources, made the situation even more desperate. Due to the Brest-Litovsk peace treaty that Germany and Russia signed on the 3rd of March 1919, large contingents of German troops could be transferred to the West Front. It was clear that a quick decision in the West must be achieved, or Germany's defeat would be sealed. On March the 21st, the anniversary of the opening of the first German Reichstag by Otto von Bismarck in 1871, and the place from which Hitler would proclaim the beginning of the Third Reich in 1933, General Ludendorff's planned Kaiserslacht began at 0440 hours in the morning. This gigantic offensive, on which Germany would gamble everything, would decide victory or defeat. On a 50-mile front, thousands of guns opened fire, shaking the ground like an earthquake. For 5 hours, German artillery relentlessly leveled enemy positions with explosive and gas shells. The seemingly never-ending thunder of artillery drowned every conversation. It was, as survivors said, like Dante's Inferno. During the following weeks, Regiment List experienced heavy losses in fighting near Laon, Lizy and Epagny. Losses for the month of April amounted to 23 officers and 1,123 other ranks. The regiment lost nearly 50% of its original strength. Among the many wounded was Hitler's friend and comrade Balthasar Brandmeier. During the last days of May, he was severely wounded by a direct hit on the regimental command post near Epagny. On August the 1st, the depleted regiment List was taken out of the front line to recuperate at a rest area near Le Cateau. There, on Sunday, August the 4th, Adolf Hitler received the Iron Cross, first class, from the hands of regimental commander Major Anton Freier von Tuboeuf. It was a rare decoration for a corporal in the German army.
Es war ja damals nicht so wie im Zweiten Weltkrieg. Es war damals schon eine hohe Auszeichnung für einen Gefreiten, das Eiserne Kreuz erster Klasse zu erhalten. Das war bestimmt eine weit über dem Durchschnitt liegende Leistung. Und seine Tapferkeit ist ja unbestritten. Es ist ja Unsinn, wenn heute aus politischen Gründen dem Mann seine damalige Haltung angezweifelt oder abgestritten wird.
Together with the Iron Cross First Class and the Wound Badge, Corporal Hitler's military record also shows him as recipient of a regimental diploma for outstanding bravery during frontline action near Fontaine. Although the majority of his superiors felt that Hitler had long deserved the Iron Cross, it remains an irony of history that it was probably the Jewish lieutenant, Hugo Guttmann, who gave the final push for the award. It's not true, as sometimes claimed, that Hitler actually received the Iron Cross First Class from the hand of Guttmann. In fact, at that time, from July the 22nd until August the 15th, 1918, Guttmann was at home on leave and could not have participated at the presentation. After the war, Guttmann, who himself had been awarded the Iron Cross First Class, would be unjustly defamed as a shirker and coward by Hitler and other former colleagues.
I never wore the Iron Cross First Class during the war because I saw how it was awarded. We had a Jew in the regiment, Guttmann, a real coward. He wore the Iron Cross First Class. It was outrageous and a disgrace.
Hitler does not reveal that he, due to home leave and later having been wounded, could not have worn the decoration for more than 2 months at the front. In spite of the precarious situation on the West Front, Hitler, as most others, did not believe as he started an 18-day home leave with Ernst Schmidt on the 8th of September that within 2 months Germany would be forced to accept a ceasefire. That he would experience such a catastrophe as being victim of a mustard gas attack, even less so. Following his home leave, Hitler returned to the front at Comines, where his regiment was subjected to constant British gas attacks. 15 days later, during October the 13th to the 14th, the war came to an end for Adolf Hitler.
Now, in the autumn of 1918, we stood for the third time on the storm site of 1914. The little town of Comines, where we had once rested, now became our battlefield. In the night of October 13th, the English gas attack on the southern front before Ypres was unleashed. They used yellow cross gas, whose effects were still unknown to us, as far as personal experience was concerned. In the same night, I myself became acquainted with it. On a hill south of Vervic, where we endured on the evening of October 13th several hours of drum fire with gas shells, which continued all night more or less violently. As early as midnight, a number of us passed out, a few of our comrades forever. Toward morning, I too was seized with pain, which grew worse with every quarter hour. At 7 in the morning, I stumbled and tottered back with burning eyes, taking with me my last report of the war. A few hours later, my eyes had turned into glowing coals. It had grown dark around me.
At the same time, on the same day, Hitler's comrade Hans Wendt also became the victim of a gas attack. His son recalls,
über die Verwundung Adolf Hitlers nach einem vermutlich englischen Gasangriff hat mein Vater berichtet, dass sie beide etwa zur gleichen Zeit ungefähr diesem oder einem Gasangriff ausgesetzt waren, die ja damals öfter stattgefunden haben, auch manchmal räumlich begrenzt. Auf alle Fälle hat mein Vater auch mit seinem Augenlicht zu tun gehabt nach einem dieser Angriffe. Und mein Vater als Münchner kam dann in die Herzog-Karl-Theodor-Klinik, in die Augenklinik. Und wie man weiß, Adolf Hitler nach Pasewalk in das Lazarett.
The injuries from the gas attack would accompany Hitler for the rest of his life, as Herbert Döring recalls.
Fleisch hat nie gegessen. Und zwar will ich noch mal zurückkommen auf die vegetarische Ernährung, auf was der Schaub gesagt hat. Das stimmt ja alles nicht. Das haben die alles nur so gesagt, damit sie was reden. Entscheidend und wahr ist es gewesen, als der Betrieb noch ganz klein war, wie meine Frau hingekommen ist die ersten Jahre, ist er oft privat in die Küche gekommen. Ja, Anna, was gibt's denn heute? Was machst du mir heute? Bloß kein Fleisch, du weißt ja, seitdem ich diese schwere Gasvergiftung im Ersten Weltkrieg hatte, kann ich kein Fleisch riechen und keine Fleischsoßen. Das widerstrebt mir. Die Schleimhäute sind total durcheinander. Ich habe keinen Geschmack. Ich muss mich übergeben. Und das ist die Gasvergiftung, ist der Grund gewesen, hat meine Frau immer später gesagt. Und auch seine Halbschwester, Frau Arupal, hat das später bestätigt, dass diese Gasvergiftung war der Übergang zu der vegetarischen Ernährung.
After initial treatment in the Bavarian Field Hospital, Hitler was transferred to the Prussian Reserve Hospital at Pasewalk near Stettin on October the 21st. There, together with his comrade Hermann Heer, who, though wounded himself, saved the life of Hitler and other blinded comrades by guiding them back from the front, his condition slowly improved. Shortly afterwards, he was informed by a military priest of the outbreak of the revolution at home, the imminent signing of the armistice on November the 11th, 1918, and the abdication of the Kaiser. Hitler suffered a spiritual and physical breakdown.
I could stand it no longer. It became impossible for me to sit still 1 minute more. Again, everything went black before my eyes. I tottered and groped my way back to the dormitory, threw myself on my bunk, and dug my burning head into my blanket and pillow. Since the day when I had stood at my mother's grave, I had not wept, but now I could not help it. Only now did I see how all personal suffering vanishes in comparison with the misfortune of the fatherland. And so it had all been in vain. In vain all the sacrifices and privations, in vain the hunger and thirst of months, which were often endless, in vain the hours in which, with mortal fear clutching at our hearts, we nevertheless did our duty.
On November the 19th, 1918, an embittered Hitler was discharged from the Reserve Field Hospital at Pasewalk as fit for field duty and transferred to the replacement battalion of his regiment in Munich. To Hitler's horror, he found it was already in the hands of the Revolutionary Workers and Soldiers Councils. At some point during the months prior to the crushing of the Bavarian Revolution Republic by government and Free Corps troops in May 1919, Corporal Adolf Hitler decided to become a politician. 14 years later, on the 30th of January 1933, the former unknown soldier of the First World War was appointed German Reich Chancellor by the aged Field Marshal and Reich President, Paul von Hindenburg. The Third Reich had begun.
So if you look at Germany before World War One, then of course you can see signs of the types of ideas that Hitler came to represent that are present in different parts of the nationalist right, on the nationalist right, amongst various groupings on the nationalist right. You can see, looking back from the Nazi period, strains there which are pushing in that direction. But it's impossible really without the First World War to imagine the traumatization of a society, the fracturing of that society to such an extent that it allowed somebody from the outside of politics to gain the sort of popularity that Hitler could get. That was only feasible in the circumstances that the First World War had left behind, which left behind a society that was absolutely riven, that was, as I said, traumatized by the experience of the war, that had produced or had accentuated the scapegoating of particular target groups, which Hitler was able to play upon, which therefore created the circumstance in which a demagogue could get a hearing, and through that hearing eventually make his way to power. So that, as I said in the book, before 1914, a Hitler on the chancellor's seat that had been held by a Bismarck would have been unthinkable.